My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this episode, we speak with a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. We talk about his multiple tours, life as a child, and his time as a member of a combat camera team. We also speak about documenting the carnage of Syria, Mosul, and Somalia. Episode 49, Mau Gris. This is Declassified. Born in Lima, Peru, 1983.
Yeah, that's right. And then from there, moved to Mexico and then back to the UK, then to Portugal, then back to the UK, and then back to Australia, and then back to the UK, and then Brazil, and then the UK.
Because your heritage is dad's
Mexican,
mum
Irish.
Where did they meet?
At school. So I'm a proper mongrel.
Well, some would say that. But what did mum and dad do then for a living?
So dad was in marketing and mum was a nurse.
Yeah. How many times did people say, was your dad a drugs cartel because he's Mexican?
Yeah, I think that most of my schoolmates were convinced that he was like the head of some cartel and that we were hiding out in the UK for various reasons.
But Charlie, growing up, then there's the Mexico, moving around, was it adventurous? Did you have an adventurous childhood?
Yeah, I mean, I was a nightmare. Like, I would, like, you could put me in a room and I'd find the trouble. Like, in Mexico, like, I was playing with, like, this basically a scorpion that would be lethal to a human. Like, my mum comes out like into the living room and I pull this thing out of the fireplace and I'm playing with it and it's obviously pissed off and like trying to hit me and whatever. And then like Portugal, climbing up like sheer cliff faces, and then Australia, got run over by a bus, you know, like all over the place. But like, it was, I definitely didn't put down any roots, but it also made me like able to chat to anyone and really like meet anyone, which has become really useful in later life, you know.
Is it just you?
No, my brother obviously as well, like my younger brother.
Your brother.
Yeah.
So that's funny, because when you move around, we'll get to when you were 13, but moving around quite a lot. Did you find it easy to make friends? Did you have good friends, or was it just like acquaintances when you was moving?
I mean, I think you have like as good of friends as you get at that age. You know, you think they're your best friends forever, don't you, at that age? But yeah, like I never had a problem making like friends or whatever. We're both quite sporty as well, so you know. Never, like, that's a great way of meeting people and stuff. So, yeah, I never had any dramas with that.
And schooling then, up until kind of teenage life, was that settled?
No, like, all over the shop. So, like, international schools and, like weird primary school in Bristol I went to, like, and the second time we were back there, and, like, all sorts. So it wasn't until, like, 13 that we sort of settled.
And then what happened at 13?
Then went to boarding school down in sort of deepest, darkest Somerset, Catholic all boys boarding school, you know, ran full of monks and stuff. So, you know, that was fun.
Yeah. Was it a change? Because you'd gone from like moving around there than everywhere.
Totally. You go from like a day school to a boarding school that's night and day anyway, you know. Like, and my parents, so at that point they'd like moved off, they'd gone off to Brazil. So we were in a different country to me. Like, school, like, the end of, like, to go on holidays, like, we would get age sort of, yeah, 12 and 11, my brother was, 13 and, sorry, 11, my brother, taken to Heathrow and put on a plane and then meet mum and dad in like, Sao Paulo, you know? Like, so we were, like, on our own.
Yeah. And so was it different? Sorry, because I always get this, because I wasn't like that. Obviously, I just lived every day at home and all the rest of it. But the connection with your parents, did that change for the better, or was that indifferent? Well, how did it change when you went for prolonged periods of time away?
Good question. I don't think it really changed. Like, we're quite a tight family as it is anyway. Like, even now, dad would just happily speak to just family and no one else. He's properly antisocial. So, like, I don't think it ever really suffered from that much, you know? I mean, it was before mobiles, right? So there was a little bit of lack of content. But I had an uncle who was teaching there, and I had like a grandma was just down the road. So, you know, we were like, it was still family around, you know.
But you was allowed freedom.
As much freedom as you can get in a boarding school, which is like they basically keep you busy from like 7 a.m. until 9. Because if you leave 350 like teenage boys alone in a building then and with nothing to do, then it's not going to be there for very long.
Yeah. And then when you went to back to Brazil, when you went to Brazil to see your parents and you were together as a family, was it adventurous times there? Was it structured? How was it?
I mean, it was quite adventurous. So we were living in Sao Paulo, which is like, it was pretty rough. You know, massive poverty and crime. Like my mum actually literally drove through a shootout. Oh. As in like police and bank robbers like shooting out and mum sort of poodles through the middle. So stuff like happened and like that. Like we were always kind of outdoorsy and stuff, and obviously get out to Brazil and we were like into the Amazon and all sorts. So, you know, we had a great, like it was some amazing adventures.
Mm. Was it an affluent childhood?
Yeah, I'd say. Like we were okay, like white collar.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but we're not like driving around with chauffeurs and stuff, if you know what I mean.
No.
Which, you know, that is for some people in Latin America, that's a possibility, but it wasn't for us.
During that time then, was your mum working as a nurse as well?
No, at that point she wasn't working because she can get some sort of medical license, I don't think, or something in Brazil. She was just housewife.
Good job, really, because if you were getting near stung by scorpions and scared of this, I was just thinking then when you were talking, I wonder if she trained as a nurse to sort you out, or this was before, but...
Yeah, probably. I think that kind of, definitely kept in handy.
Yeah.
Came then in handy.
Left school, left boarding school at 18. Was it uni next?
Gap year and then uni, yeah.
Mm.
I did sociology at Exeter. Was a bit of a like reaction to being forced to do more traditional A-levels because I wanted to do something I had no clue about. And it was a terrible choice because I did not care about sociology at all.
What is it?
Sociology is like the study of how people act as groups. I mean, even now, I struggle to define it because I just spent so little time looking at it or watching it. You know, I was all sort of sports and worked in a bar and, you know, just basically did anything but university, pretty much.
Mm. And when was the interest of the military come in then?
I had loads of mates who were sort of, you know, on some sort of scholarship or bursary to go into the military. And... my school turns out a lot of military, has quite a rich military history. So I've been exposed to it from the age of about 13. Always kind of like been interested in it in tandem with loving the kind of creative side of life. But I had never like done any kind of concrete steps to sort of go towards it until towards sort of the end of uni.
Mm.
Because there was that itch. And as people were sort of prepping to go, and also it's like sociology is no use for anyone, really. So going to like getting to go to when everyone was going, I was kind of like, I've got an itch there. You know, if I don't go now, then I'll never go. I'll miss that opportunity.
What itch?
The itch, you know, the itch
to have to serve.
Yeah, to serve to see if you can, see if you could do it.
Yeah. And then you went through the process. You had a bit of time off after uni. Most people go to work in London or Brighton. Did you go to Argentina?
Yeah. So I still can't ride a horse despite being in the household cab, right? And I basically stretched the truth to this ranch in Cordoba saying that, yeah, I can ride a horse, like literally no problems. And of course, I couldn't. I had like 4 lessons. I could like just about trot. And of course, it's totally different riding there anyway. So it didn't make any difference. And they obviously found that like day one. Like they put me on a horse, said, right, we'll go, we'll like do a loop. And of course, these horses have been doing this loop for like years. So they know exactly when it's halfway. So like they know when they're going to go back. So you spend the first half there like kicking them to get them to go. And then the halfway moment you kick them, they go like the clappers. And it turns out that in Argentina, there's actually loads of thistles. Like it should be their national plant because I was dragged through about 2 miles of it. And then I got in and they were like, you can't horse ride, Kenya. I was like, no, but I am here. And so like I actually did by the end of that, learn how to like Western ride, which is like cowboy riding, right? It's not English proper, proper riding. So it was no use to me in like the house or calf at all. But, you know, it was a great experience.
Yeah, cowboy. More of a side saddle guy.
Yeah, exactly. Way too dainty for that, for the proper, like, rig.
But you did join, why did you join the cavalry?
I loved the job, and they were the best unit doing it at the time, as far as my colour sergeant was concerned at Sandhurst.
Yeah.
So, like, I went there and had, like, rifles down as my first choice the whole time. But like everyone in Sandhurst, you go there with infantry on your car, and then you're like, infantry is like, walking everywhere is just not that much fun. And also I really liked all of the people that I met who were like going cavalry. Like, they were quite like engaging and like fast, quick witted and fast. So yeah, I chatted to them, was like, what's the best regiment? Which regiment is going to go to Afghanistan? Because obviously I went in 2000, I was in Sandhurst in 2007. And obviously Helmand had just kicked off the year before. I'm the kind of guy that if I'm going to go and do something, I want to do it. So I was like, right, yeah, household cav.
Mm. And they were going to Afghan.
Yeah, I knew they were coming round, having done Herrick 4, to come round to go to do Afghan again. So, like, chose those guys, and they were keen.
I always thought, until I've met quite a few lads recently in the last few years, that the house of cav was very, very posh and very isolated. And
I'm not incredibly posh. What are you talking about? Sorry.
And good lads.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I'm not a good lad.
So, yeah, exactly. There we go. No, but it was more isolated, and not just anyone could go join. And certainly it wasn't part of war fighting. It was more ceremonial. And that's what this perception I had. And so you start delving into the history of it, and it's very rich, and, you know, tales of valor and all this just amazing history around it. When you got in, when you finally got in before the first Herrick you went on, was you happy? Was you happy to be there?
Yeah, really happy. But I mean, like, I commissioned like middle of 07, and then I was on into my second phase training. So I was like, I wasn't really at regiment as such. I was like, I was in Bovington, I was in Lulworth, learning to be a troop commander. Mm. So I wasn't really in regiment at that point. And then I joined, and then we were straight into pre-deployment training. So again, I was like, I was with my squadron, but not with the wider regiment or within the mess. And the household cav throughout Herrick was like, there was either pretty much either the regiment was deployed or a single squadron was always deployed throughout the, like, you know, from like 2006, you know, because they were on the Herrick 4, we were on Herrick 8, then 12 and 16, I think it was. So up until sort of like, yeah, post 2012, there was like, the regiment was just like turning and turning. So you weren't really seeing all that many people.
Mm. Before we get to why that was, Herrick 8.
Mm.
So you went as a troop commander.
Correct.
Was even though you'd traveled the world and you'd done all this at such a young age anyway, was this a daunting task, or was you up for it?
Oh, yeah, you're so up for it. And I think it was the way it was done at that point. It builds you up for it.
Mm.
So, and the thing that really stuck with me was like, my very first sort of contact or firefight was almost to a letter exactly like my last training serial. So like, we were just driving along, and in the training serial, they'd fired two like fireworks over the top of us that made that kind of noise. And then the engagement had started from one side, and that is exactly what happened to me on my first proper contact. Was two RPGs flew over the top of my wagon, and then everyone turned, and it was like a massive firefight.
Mm.
So I was really felt ready for it, and I felt prepared for it, and I was kind of, you know, like any soldier, you want to kind of do the job.
Mm. Was it full on that? Because that was a summer tour. Was it full on?
It, you know, with all of my tours, they always test you, but it's never how you expect it. That tour, we expected to be like fighting every day, crunchy. It was meant to be like the sequel to Herrick 4 for the paras, right? But we didn't have that. We had a guy killed on the first day, which made us think that we were going into something a lot worse. And then we really had nothing until the last month, when we were down in the south in a place called Garm Seir, which was like the last bit of control that we had in Helmand at that point. Below that was just badlands, right the way down to Pakistan. And we were like, we were supporting the 24th MEU, so the Marine Expeditionary Unit, which is the equivalent of the whole British Army. Like, it's 100,000 people, you know, and 30,000 fighting soldiers support with support arms, right? And they took that out. This is when I first realised just like the scale of the US military versus us. They took that out and moved it because they wanted to do something else. And they left 300 bods, right, in us. And it was, you know, like within like 3 hours, like everyone and his dog had realised that it was just us left. And then it was mental, you know, like hardcore fighting at least once or twice a week and skirmishes all the time otherwise, you know.
Mm. And where are you working out of?
So we were working out of Fob Dwyer, I think it was. The one that was not in the green zone.
Right. And was that safe?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, because you can't get up close. I mean, even I can't remember the name of the fob that was inside Garm Seir at that point, but outside it was kind of desert, and then it dropped off into the green zone. So we were kind of remote from people, and no one was interested in anything in the desert. Like, people were just like running drugs and stuff down to Pakistan from there. So there wasn't any. It was only when you went into the green zone or were trying to like support the guys on the like front line, as it was at that time.
So what would you do? Would the infantry be on the line with supporting, and then you'd go in to support them? In what was you in vehicles?
Yes, we were initially in CVRTs, which are those little tanks, like that were just like they'd been up armored to death. They've been around since Malaysia, right? And they just had bits added on. So a 10-ton tank was about a 30-ton tank by the time it got to us. Okay. Yeah. and then they'd been out for like, they'd been out in like hardcore desert being driven to death effectively by the time we got there. So we had a whole, like, our first trip where we lost Babs, we had like 2/3 to 3/4 of the fleet fail, like on the way up and down there. So we had to like come back in, reconstitute, learn a new like system, and then go out again. So we were the first lot onto Jackals, which are those, like, they look like really big four wheels, but like with no cover. There's no like roof or anything to them. They've got big guns on the back and rifle and machine guns on the front.
And you'd go in, and how would you support the infantry? You'd go in guns
you'd
blazing,
be fine,
would you?
Go, no, well, I mean, it wasn't really so much going in, but you'd be on the outskirts firing in, or you'd be transiting through and they'd call for support, or you'd be inside a forward operating base. And then if they were in, they'd build these kind of ramps so you could like drive up and your main armaments would like point over the top to be able to support them, you know?
Do you enjoy it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's what you joined to do, isn't it?
I mean, was you single then?
Yeah.
Yeah, so single.
I was single all the way through the army.
Yeah. And I mean, but from a kind of risk perspective, that you'd gone through 5 months of not what you expected to that final month. Is that a kicker? Or is that something? Is that a good thing? Because I've never heard it that way before on a tour, where you've had nothing and it's just gone absolute mental at the end, especially in a summer tour. So why?
I think in the initial instance, me and everyone, we were just pleased that we had done something, you know. I don't know whether that's a particularly healthy way to look at it.
Well, good, like, for the CV kind of thing.
Yeah, for the military CV. Yeah. Like, to have gone on a summer tour and not fired a shot in anger would have been pretty, I think, embarrassing for everyone. But then by the end of it, it's like, come on, lads. This is, you know, everyone's starting to look at their watch. You know, our replacements coming in. And like, well, I actually had one of the replacements shot on my patrol in an ambush. So like, God knows what the Queen's Dragoon Guards were thinking when their continuity officers are coming back injured before they've even made it out. They must have thought they were going into, you know, like World War or something, you know. But yeah, it's a step change. Like, because it was hard, that, like, the not fighting thing was hard on everyone. because you've gone out and you've prepared yourself, and then, you know, you're kind of sat around not really doing anything.
Mm. Boring.
Boring. Yeah, yeah.
You came back, then you went out again on Herrick 11, which is 2009, so a year later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What was your role then?
So I was a tactical air control party officer. So I was a forward air controller in the first instance, which is coordinating air power. So strikes and, So I was a tactical air control party officer, but also a forward air controller. So a forward air controller is someone who coordinates between the air and the ground for, you know, air strikes and casualty evacuation, essentially, and sort of surveillance if you've got drones. And then the TAC party bit is, and the TACP bit is coordinating between, over an area, a whole different, of loads of different forward air controllers. You're allocating resources and deconflicting where the aircraft can go, essentially, like an air tower.
Was that busy?
Yeah, that was a really busy tour. Because that was Sangin.
Yeah.
That was three rifles. So it was like one of the bloodiest, if not the bloodiest tour, with, you know, 30-odd people killed and then another 90-odd with like life-changing injuries.
Mm.
And, you know, I wasn't actually out on the ground for that one. I was in the main operating base there. And I went out once to cover for another forward air controller somewhere else. But other than that, I was pretty much at a desk. But that was harder for me than the other ones because you're every week we were evacuating someone who died, it's called an angel flight. We're organizing an angel flight for someone, or we were evacuating people who'd been seriously wounded. And you're listening to people every day who are having the worst day of their lives and trying to, like, you're the only person in that group, operations room who can, like, do something about it. So the pressure was pretty intense.
I was going to say the pressure there it's not a video game, it's not a film, is it? You're almost slightly detached as well, I should imagine. You're not there on the ground smelling it all, but you're the one that can do the big gun can come in from you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can, you know, you're watching someone who you know, like, rather than a shootout or a contact, as we call it, like, you know, this person has no idea you're watching him or that you can kill him.
Mm.
And you see the person that you've killed go down and you know that they're gone.
Mm. Was it, although it was difficult and you're in Sangin, an absolute, you know, did they call it a hornet's nest or whatever? It was the main area. Was it satisfying? Did you get job satisfaction from what you were doing?
Yeah, in the aftermath, definitely. But, you know, there's stuff you could have done better. There's always stuff you could have done better. Could have deconflicted, could have checked this, could have done that. And there's definitely, you know, that stuff definitely stays with you, but it's not, doesn't weigh particularly. You did what you could, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you're only ever going to learn from things, you know? That's why you have hot debriefs there and then, and you reflect on it later on. It was funny, because as soon as I asked that question, I thought, I wonder if this was going to be something he thought of afterwards. He had satisfaction after, and he reflected back on it. So after Herrick 11, this is where another thing I've never heard before, the way this has worked. You did Herrick 18, which is 2013, but in between that, you then did two or three smaller tours, like month-long tours with a combat camera crew. Why did you go from that Herrick 11 role into a combat camera crew?
So, yeah, it's a good question. Like, a lot of, like, so I'd done the New York Film Academy when I was at Exeter for a summer. Like, I loved filmmaking and all the rest of it, but I didn't have a family of filmmakers. My family are not particularly arty. Exeter's like pretty green wellies. So there's never really a kind of arty scene there particularly that I would have got myself into. And on my first tour, I saw the combat camera team and was like, yes, that is a way of getting, like, on the job training. And I knew I wasn't a career soldier. Like, I wasn't going to be some washed up major, which is definitely what I'd have ended up being. So, like, after Herrick 11, I was like, right, you know, so I kind of applied and I had to go. I did 6 months teaching down second phase recruits, which is weirdly really rewarding in the summer, like in Bournemouth, so like lovely weather and stuff. And then went and did the combat camera team, and that was the best job ever because, like, I was in Army Land, so like Andover, where the most junior BOD is a major normally. So like as a captain, I was so far below anyone's radar that I could do whatever I liked. At that point, 2010, I got there, I think. 2011. Like, people still had no clue about media. To an extent, the army is still getting to grips with it, but, like, social media, all of that stuff was like, what? So I could do... And being, like, a curious bloke, as long as I could, like, write a business case to go and do something, or... if I found something interesting and I could be eloquent enough in front of the right people, I could go and do it. So like we went to like Jordan, like went to Belize, Germany, like all, just doing all sorts of stuff. And like I was just teaching myself the nuts and bolts of filmmaking. And you know, we started introducing like shooting with DSLRs and, you know, turning out like a higher quality product. And because... the thing that I'd always sought, I realized I like working in small teams. I like working with motivated, intelligent soldiers, right? That's part of the reason that I went to the Cav, because like generally a higher caliber soldier. And I never went to court once, which when I tell my like infantry officer mates, they're like, what? You never went to, you know, so, and you know, that, and the combat camera team was an extension of that because like they've all had to pass a pretty significant course to get there. And it's that kind of like weird, it was the start of that weird blend of like the creativity and the art, where the creativity and army meet, which was fascinating. Mm. And with that, we were like occasionally having to go out to support a media effort in Afghanistan, be it for like Remembrance Day or whatever. So we would dob out there for like a month or so to shoot something.
But was it just... low risk stuff?
Oh, so we're still on patrol, Nadi Ali and a few other places, but like, yeah, I would call it low risk relatively. Mm. But if you were coming at it with no combat experience, it would have felt a little bit scarier than it actually was.
Mm. And is it tougher than to kind of acclimatize yourself, or is it literally life through a lens? As in, you go out there, is it easier for you to transition in and out quickly, whereas, you know, the 6 months you bed in, you get used to everything, and then you go through those phases? Whereas with this, going out for a specific task, was it easy or was it more difficult?
I've never really had a problem transitioning between, like, you know, that kind of environment to a home environment, weirdly. I don't know why. So it never really was for me particularly. I think we had a bunch of, I was going out with guys I was working with day in, day out with a very defined task. It never really was a problem, to be honest.
Mm. Do you carry weapons?
Yeah, yeah. So the idea behind combat camera team, like started by Winston Churchill, was like that these people they'd be soldiers first. So, you know, you can go out and you can take up a seat on a heli that might be reserved for a fighting soldier, film, and if it gets too dangerous, then you start fighting. Like the line is like to cover things that are too dangerous or politically sensitive for like media, mainstream media. Mm.
And then and also other lads around you don't have to worry about.
Yeah, you. they're not worried about some overweight cameraman that's going to have heat stroke on patrol, or someone who's going to freak out when there's a contact or whatever.
Mm. Herrick 18, 2013, you did the full summer with the combat camera teams.
Yeah.
What was that? How did that pan out? Was that the similar thing? Was it going doing specific little jobs, or was you going in there with squadrons or battalions or whatever? How was that working?
So you go there to provide the media capability for the brigade that's out there at the time. The beauty of it is, though, that is like back at home, like you're not in the direct chain of command of the brigadier in Helmand. Your chain of command is further, like in Kabul or CAF in this case. So, you know, again, it was like find interesting stuff and get it into the media. So I could literally walk around, like I could go on ops, went on some absolutely crazy ops. And luckily it was the household cav who were out there. So I was attached. Mm. So I could just wander over to some guys who I knew and said, you got a couple of spaces for us? And they knew me. So like, yeah, sure, whatever. So, you know, we got to go to some epic stuff.
So real war fighting stuff.
You
were there.
I mean, I almost got ag-eyed. I got censured essentially for refusing to like, this was meant to be painted as the last fighting summer. Right. So like, no, there's going to be no fighting. The Afghans were taking care of it all. When in fact people were still fighting, like my regiment was still heavily engaged. And I was just like refusing to kind of put out soft puff pieces about, you know, schools that had been built but weren't really used and all the rest of it. Mm. So the best job I did in the army by a long stretch.
And what, you know, when you said before, you said it was a crazy tour, and we just mentioned like the war fighting, but actually this transitional time really in this transitional tour. But were medals being awarded? Were proper operations going on? Can you go into a bit more?
Yeah, so like I'd say the craziest stuff that we did was with the Brigade Reconnaissance Force. So it's like there was this op called I call it Old School House because that was the name of the target, which was supposed to be this like high level command and control node for the Taliban right inside the heart of darkness, which we called Yak Chow, which we'd been in a couple of times before, and always there was always a scrap. We'd actually like wherever we went got hit essentially, and we had my poor cameraman guy called Sergeant Baz Lloyd, who was great northern lad, was carrying, in one of these instances, I'd blagged a 3D camera. But this 3D camera had a lens that was about a foot long. So it made it look like some supersonic, super duper weapon. So you hear like on the Taliban on the radio being like, get the guy with the big gun, get the guy with the big gun. That's just like, oh my God. So we were, old school house was like a heli assault at night into this town called Yak Chow, and onto this objective that we thought was a big command node, or they thought was a big command node. Turned out it was just a madrasa, so like a religious school. And so I was left like on at Old School House with a sniper called Cy Maloney, who was on the roof, and a couple of other guys who were attachments guarding it, whilst everyone else went to look for like caches and see if we could drum something up from this op. And I sent my two cameramen, my cameraman and my stills photographer, off to go and with these guys get some action shots. And then, like, what we didn't know is that we really pissed off the local Taliban there, because this was quite a significant spot for them. Like, it had a lot of emotional attachment to it. So we got smashed. Like, they shot Sai through the throat because. Yeah, I'll tell you about this anyway. The whole world opened up on us with everyone else about 2 miles down. So, like, I'm in the bottom of this compound. I look up to see the roof of this compound erupt around Sai, and I see him roll off. And it's not particularly dignified, so I think he might be hit. And he stands up. He's got two clean holes either side of his Adam's apple, bleeding. And he's going, am I done? Is this me? And I had that moment of like, oh, I mean, you're shot in the neck, like you're clearly shot in the neck, but you are fine, and there's not blood pissing out of here or anything. So I think you're okay. I don't know. I phoned in two medevac like requests in my life, right? And both of them, I've been like, I think it's kind of serious, but I'm not sure. Like, the first one was with this continuity guy in Africa in 2008 who got shot through the side, like the meaty side of your chest, but like not his chest. It was his lat. And like, so it's a hot, like he's bleeding from his chest. Like, I think he's a cat three, but I could be a cat one. Like, and then Sai, who was talking to me, but clearly had a bullet hole through his neck. So, you know, I got on the thing and was like, I didn't even have a call sign at that point. I wasn't like part. I didn't have a radio, nothing. I was just like attached. Got on and like came and was like, oh, this is Charlie Tango, like combat camera team leader. You need to get back here. Your sniper's been hit, and we're like, there are four of us in this building, and you guys are all a K away. So, you know, long story short, the medic won an MC for running back through a hail of fire to then come up and basically perform the most perfect thing he could have done for Sai's neck, which wasn't in any of the training books. And if he had done what the training books stipulate, he would have killed Sai because he would have crushed his neck in doing it, because he obviously had destabilized the neck. But he chopped up the first field dressing and then like sealed it off. And then Sai won a conspicuous gallantry cross for fighting on for 3 hours after that, because it obviously just rolled on. So yeah, that's the type of thing that we like. That's the kind of crazy op that we were occasionally getting dropped into for that.
I'm going to give you points for the crazy op.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I'm sure I've messed up loads of that. I'm going to get
50% were awarded gallantry medals. And you weren't in that 50%.
Yeah. Well, you know, go look up number one. Support, yeah. Heroes support. Don't get paid anymore.
Yeah. Mate, you left 2014. Was that an easy decision to make?
Yeah. So the combat camera team, to anyone who's a thrusting officer, that is a career cul-de-sac. Like, you've not had any command, you've not done anything particularly crunchy, like, you've career fouled yourself effectively. So in taking that job, I knew I was out. And I agreed to go on the combat camera team tour because I knew it would give me really good training and I'd meet loads of really great people. Like, all the top journalists were still kind of going through at that point, before I went into my journalism master's, right? So I finished like the September, on a Friday in September. And then that Monday, like, I'd Friday I stepped off the plane from Afghanistan. Monday I stepped into a lecture hall at City Uni. Like, a bunch, you know, age 30 with a whole bunch of 24, 25-year-olds to do my master's. It was quite a, like, head spin, that, for sure.
So was you full-time in education?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So every day in lectures, learning about journalism.
Yeah. You do like placements as well. So, you know, I was in Sky News, I was in ITN, I was in, you know, I was learning on the job, which is part of the reason I did that master's, because they've got great placements.
Mm. And was the end goal to get back, what, into a newsroom? Was it to get out into the field?
Really,
where
know.
Did you want to be?
I didn't really know at that point exactly what I wanted to do. Like, I knew that I loved the kind of adrenaline of, and the drive of getting, like, of doing like hardcore breaking news where you're like, right, something's happened over there, drop everything, get over there, get it, get the first, get, you know, get the interviews, whatever. But I also loved the like craftsmanship and the time of getting to know people, doing long form documentary stuff. So this was my way of getting a bit of theoretical underpinning to my practical understanding, and also working out what I wanted to do. You know, that's why I did a number of placements. I did Newsnight, which is kind of like, you know, a political program, which is daily but goes out at a later time and is a little bit more considered. I did ITN and Sky News because that's rolling news. So, you know, you're in the newsroom, you're in the thick of it. And then I did, I think it was Dispatches, which is like, an investigative, a half-hour investigative thing that Channel 4 does. And I was like a T-boy for a few weeks there.
Mm. How did you end up in Syria?
So throughout all of that, I had kind of, being a student, I was spending a lot of time on the internet. I'd come across this Facebook group that was essentially recruiting Westerners to come and fight in Syria with no military training. They're called the Reliance of Rojava. And it just blew my mind that literally all you had to do was talk to the admin on this thing, buy a ticket, send the admin a picture of your ticket and a picture of yourself, which he already kind of has because it's your Facebook mates, and then they would pick you up and then drive you into Syria. You get 2 weeks training and then you're into it. And that,
like, British kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. From anywhere in the world. Like, I met Portuguese, Canadian.
But
I met
white kids, black kids. You know,
literally anyone. Huh. And so I was like, right, you know, and I kind of, I was, get, I was, I picked up some work doing some kind of journalism, but I really wasn't enjoying it because it was, I was divorced from the creative process. I was essentially writing a timed essay every day that would then get ripped apart literally by Jeremy Paxman before trying to find two people who were like respectable but diametrically opposed views to then have a scrap on TV, you know. It was good money, but it was like, no, not for me. I wanted to be filming. I wanted to be out there talking to people. One of the whole reasons of doing this. And so, April 2015, you know, put the last 5K I had left from my Afghan tour to buying a ticket to Syria and a camera. And with two other army blokes, or ex-military blokes, went out and... went out to Syria, yeah, when ISIS were sort of on the full advance, still, you know, on their way into Rojava, which is like northeastern Syria.
Mm. So what happened when you... So you went out there to fight to...
We didn't know what we were going to find, right. But I wanted to cover this story about Western people going to fight in a war.
These non-military foreign volunteers.
Exactly.
When you said it, I just think in this Call of Duty kind of generation, seeing something, you know, we've already just... talked about the reality of war and conflict, you know, this first half. What did you find?
I found a bit of the Call of Duty stuff, although they would never kind of admit that. Like, so we went out, we got dropped on the front line, which was this place just to the west of a place called Tiltama. Like, it was the first point at which ISIS had been stopped. It was proper sort of trenches across arable country. So we literally got there was a big trench, a berm of like 2 meters high of earth. And then across a field 200 meters, there was an ISIS flag flying. And then in this trench system, there was what they call a tabor, which is like the name for a platoon of like Westerners and mixed Kurds, right? So we had a 40-year-old ex-loggy turned peace activist who was fighting there. We had a 21-year-old IT painter-decorator chap from Bournemouth. We had a Portuguese ex-naval person, a 67-year-old Canadian. Yeah, like, what are you doing here? and we had a 27-year-old banker, like well-spoken banker from East Anglia. We got 2 or 3 weeks there to bed in with them, and then there was this massive operation, which would turn out to be like the first time that ISIS got turned back in their kind of westward expansion from like Raqqa and stuff, up to the Abdulaziz Mountains. And that was like Mad Max stuff. You're in a kind of like raiding party of like tanks, Russian looted tanks and BTRs and Hiluxes and stuff, going from like village to village clearing ISIS out. And then every night there's just an absolute barrage of American ordnance going down in front of you that's like lighting up the sky from 10k away.
And you're just with this, is it an army? Is it a militia?
It's a militia. So you're like, and that was a, you know, that was a bit of a head scratcher initially, because you're like, you know, having come from the army, you think you know how to do stuff. And you think you know how stuff works. And then you get the militia, and like the militia's like, yeah, we're just gonna go on a resupply, and you're like, okay, great. And then they come back and it's just like like 4 crates of rotten tomatoes, and that is you for like 2 days. I lost a stone and a half in a month. and you know, I learned that a resupply is not a resupply in the sense that we would understand it. It's a resupply is, I'm going to go over to that village and see what has been left behind, and then I'm going to bring it here for you to eat, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And that was like a running thing for
survival,
us.
Not more than
survival, and just what can we do to keep it going. And like, it's less hierarchical, the Kurdish system. So it's like, you know, you have effectively a platoon commander and a resupply sergeant, and then some people who are occasionally like section commanders, but not really. And then everyone else.
Mm. Did it obviously did work, but was it working? If that makes sense.
Yeah. But not in the sense that we would understand it, you know, like stuff would happen, but it would be a bit disjointed.
And when you first said it then, the trenches stuff, was it like the First World War kind of stuff?
Yeah, but not like muddy Somme type stuff, but it was there was a proper dugout trench, and then a berm of dug up, freshly dug Earth to like 2 meters.
And how would they fight? Would they go in open?
They'd like raid occasionally, but really it was a stalemate at that point.
Right.
Like, they'd shoot, they'd snipe at each other. Like, that was the first time I properly appreciated the effect a sniper can have on a group of people, because like, I'm 6'2", and like, you can't, I was hunched over for like the 3 weeks I was there. And like, I remember distinctly, I got up at like, I was probably like 4:30, 5:30 for like sunrise. I was like, I'm going to go and get some nice shots of like of sunrise at this place that we're staying. And I was on a road, a metal road that was raised slightly behind the village. So like, there was me, village, berm, field, ISIS, right? 4:30 in the morning. And I'm there mincing around. I'm like, oh, this is nice. And then like, it can't have been more than like a meter above my head. And I was like, and I ducked down and was like, oh, you know, that shot didn't even make it into the documentary in the end. I nearly got my head blown off for it. So it's just like, you know, I really, really appreciated the effect that snipers could have on a group of men by then.
But just for that shot, it was, I appreciate the fact that you did me, road, Ben, trench, field, ISIS. That combination of words has never been put into a sentence before.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that.
Okay, good. Well, at least you got that. But I nearly had my brains blown out over a shot that was totally unnecessary.
And I've heard this before many times, but I think I've said it here, but this, is there not an invincibility, but is there a detachment because you are looking through a lens?
Definitely. You're like, your brain is so focused on like that little square in front of you and what's in it. And is it correctly exposed? Is it in focus? Am I capturing the right action? What's happening next with your other eye so that you can point that the right way, that you can definitely forget to an extent what you're doing.
Mm.
And that'll catch you out, not just because you'll step out into something, but because you don't necessarily notice what's going on around you. So, for example, you know, again, you know, I've talked about how, like, you never really, as a soldier, you think you understand how someone's going to clear a village. You know, it's like assault, suppress reserves, suppress reserve. That kind of, like, bouncing rhythm of sections that a platoon will go through to clear whatever it is, whether it be a woodblock in Stony Bridge or, you know, like a building in wherever, Longmoor, right? And so, me and the two guys I was with were like, right, all we're going to do for this is like, we're not looking to get in amongst it. We will just be with the lame and lazy in the reserve section, watching people go in, and then we will come in afterwards, right? And we'll put some GoPros on people so that we're not in amongst it, right? And so we're all focused doing our filming and stuff, and I'm with the section that I think is not going anywhere. So we're running along, like filming feet. We're now in open cover, like people are starting to shoot at us, but I'm assuming we're running to our next bit of cover. Feet, filming heads, right? Let's get a bit of the point of view of where they're running to. And I kind of realised that we're running towards an armoured vehicle and there's nothing else like around. And up until this point, like pretty much all the Westerners that had died because they'd been in or around armoured vehicles. Because in a flat arable place like Syria, northeastern Syria, an armoured vehicle can change the side of a battle. Because you've got a big weapon, right?
Mm.
So I check step. And if I'd been looking, I'd have noticed that we were running that way, which is my point about, you know, get you in trouble. I check step to go, right, do I run back or do I stay with these guys? Decided I couldn't run back because there's really no one behind me. But in checking step, I was now going to be the last person into this armoured vehicle, right? And this armoured vehicle then took off, like, to assault the ISIS village, and I'm the last person in this armoured vehicle, so I am now going to be the first person out of the armoured vehicle with a camera, and that's it. Now, and my ECBA, which was like a body armour plate that's about the size of an A1 or whatever.
A5.
A5, yeah, that's it. Smaller, isn't it?
Yeah.
And sure enough, ran out into what effectively was like a 270 degree firefight because we were having a blue on blue at the same time as well.
Are you recording?
Yeah. No. Worse. I didn't record the Get Out because I was so trying to work out. I was hiding behind a telephone transformer that turned out to be empty in the middle of all of this. I hadn't hit record for the crucial bit of actually getting out of the vehicle.
Is that kind of stuff scarier when there's the kind of small lulls in between things?
Yeah.
Than it would be if you were with the British military.
Sorry, what do you mean?
Is your fear heightened because you haven't got a weapon and you're around a team of guys that know you and you know how to operate in between the not looking through the lens and in a lull of a battle in Afghanistan?
I don't think the fear's heightened, but I think you're very aware that someone could fire their weapon accidentally or something could just blow up for no reason, because there isn't that level of training around you.
Mm.
And you're also very aware, or we were very aware, that it's not, if you get hit, it's not a Chinook filled with doctors and nurses coming to get you. It's someone's going to tie a turban, a piece of cloth around your leg or bullet hole or whatever, and then they're going to put you in a Hilux and you're going to drive 4 hours to what is effectively a pharmacy, and then you're going to wait another bit, and then you're going to have to go across a river at night, and then another 4 hours down before you get to any kind of proper hospital.
Why do it?
Why do that?
Why go to these places which are such high risk?
Mm. I still love that. Why I did all of those tours is that I felt that was my best self at that point. And I was still incredibly curious and loved that type of environment and collecting. It felt well, this was history. This was history unfolding in front of your eyes. And I've always loved that in those kind of areas, is that, this is proper, life and death stuff all the way through. There's some really significant stories playing out that you can bring to the world.
And sadly, I think conflict does pivot history, and there are the central areas around it, and documenting it is an important part of it. You go right back to the Roman times when the people were documenting, and before that. Let's move to Nepal. When you went out, you got asked to go out, you met David Wiseman, you went out there as, I suppose, the memory, the first parts of Team Rubicon UK.
Yeah, I think Rubicon had been established a little bit by then, but this was the second or third trip to Nepal after that horrific earthquake in 2015. And this was my first sort of foray into telling stories for charity and for something that other than journalism. And I wasn't really, they hadn't really engaged me to make a film. It was more to shoot and to capture stills of the event. I met David Wiseman, friend of the show here. And that kind of sparked me into doing a lot of what I still do now, which is telling stories for charities, veteran charities that want to help people redefine themselves post-traumatic injury, be that mental or physical.
Mm. How long was you out there?
How long was I out in Nepal?
Yeah.
I think it was probably 3 weeks. I tell you what, though. Got there, had my wallet and my GoPro lifted off me within 2 hours. I didn't even made it out of the airport and I'd lost those two things. We then went out on a night out, and have you ever had that rice wine that they have there? Fermented rice wine. It tastes and smells like that bit of sick that comes up when you've got nothing else left to come up. Yeah, bile, that's it. It is horrific. and honestly, we then had to do, imagine the worst hanging you've ever had to do. And then we had a 4 hour trip up to the Annapurna route. So rocky mountain roads. And I can't imagine what the Rubicon guys thought of me, because I turned up, lost everything, sick everywhere because I was so hungover. And then the last night, you know how they step the sides of the mountain so that they can farm them, right? I was doing some shooting for the goodbye ceremony, photos. And in the night, I basically stepped off the back of one of these steps into their their disused glass bottle bank, and landed 2 foot into like this bottle bank, and a like massive cart, like the whole village, and all of the Rubicon guys were like over the top of staring at me, like, "What are you?" And you go to Syria, right? How are you still alive? And I'm trying to do like the British thing, like, "It's all right, it's all right, it's fine, like." Try not to like think about the glass and all the rest of it is sticking into me. Yeah. So that was actually more dangerous than a lot of the stuff I've done.
Well, don't do stuff for charity.
No, that's my motto.
That's the motto, yeah. Mate, so Mosul now, 2017. Could you set the picture of Mosul in 2017?
So this was like, Mosul was the jewel in ISIS's crown. It was like, it's basically the most urban fighting that there's been since Stalingrad.
What country?
Iraq.
Yeah.
So northwestern Iraq, like huge, huge proper city, not like a village or anything. It's a city. I arrived in the like lull of battle when they were just ready to clear the final like western side of it. They'd done most of it, and they were now doing the old quarter, like the worst fighting you've seen ever in living memory, essentially, beyond sort of Stalingrad. I was filming with a Golden Division guy who had been wounded very early on in the campaign and wanted to come back to basically face down ISIS in his home, in his backyard. That story essentially, unfortunately, fell apart while I was there because our access, the chap who was going to give us access, got killed, and then we got shut out. So I was there trying, I was filming other stories and collecting rushes to hopefully sell on to other news agencies and make my own short film. And like, I've never seen anything like it, like properly biblical destruction. And like, at least in Afghanistan or in Syria in 2015, like there's a line, and then beyond that line is bad guys, and then on this side is good guys. Whereas Mosul was like, and it's also like, you're not looking at third and fourth stories, and you're not looking in gutters, that first urban warfare, and you can't tell where anyone's shooting at you from because it echoes all the way around. So it's terrifying, I'd say. Probably, I'd say that was the scariest kind of war situation I've ever been in terms of like fearing for getting it wrong, you know.
Sorry, you might have said it. Is it walled? Is there an outer wall to
Mosul? No.
Oh, okay,
not
sorry.
Really. No, it's not an outer wall, but it's, you know, it's built up like city with, you know, proper residential houses and tower blocks and stuff. So they were throwing everything at it to keep it. Loads of, you know, they developed to the point where they were using, we got tracked by a drone and bracketed and had mortars following us down the road, and one that actually landed in a grass patch right next to us, and if it had not been grass, which was a high likelihood because it's a city, and it was, luckily we were in a nice residential area which had grass, that would have gone off, and I would probably have been pretty seriously injured. But we were, so yeah, we were just going in and out with the brigade commander, and I was staying with a bunch in a house that was like the R&R dropping off point for the Golden Division guys who were going in and out, having been obviously fighting for however long, months and months, sustaining somewhere in the region of like 75% casualties.
And a lot of these Golden Division guys, were they locals?
Not necessarily locals, but they were Iraqis. Right, so like, yeah. But they'd come from sort of Baghdad or whatever. They weren't Kurds, despite being in the kind of Kurdish area. They were Iraqis.
The reason I say it, did they still feel like they were pushing away the bad guys from their homes?
No, but this was, for them, this was personal now, because ISIS had killed so many of their blanks that they were motivated by sort of blood, being out for blood.
And how did that spill over?
So how did it spill over? I mean, I'm sure everyone's seen now the photos that came out when the city kind of finally fell. You know, they effectively stopped any journalists going in for the final push, and like, you know, you talk about what happened when Troy, when spot. Who is it? God in Seoul. When a city gets sacked, you know, the pillaging that goes on there. So I'm sure people have seen the stuff that comes out there. But I got a kind of an inkling that was coming, because the guys who were coming out, you know, you'd spend an afternoon having chai, and there's nothing to do in that particular thing. So people sit on their phones or joke or whatever. But then they get out the phones and they start showing the stuff they've got. And, you know, there's this kid being this, like, 17-year-old boy, might have been an ISIS fighter, getting sodomized by a pole, you know. And there's that, this guy's laughing at it and kind of expecting you to kind of laugh with him. And it just sort of, you know, kind of takes you aback a bit, you know, and just other stuff that's just horrendous.
And what did you find after you were allowed in? Is it more of the same?
So I left before that thing actually fell, but before Mosul proper fell. But, you know, it's just like wherever someone had fallen, they'd just be in mincemeat, essentially. You know, just guts and everything everywhere, you know.
What do you put together then when you come back? You spend X amount of time in somewhere like Mosul, you know, like you said, this kind of Stalingrad-esque location. You come back to the UK. Do you then start producing short film? How does that?
Back then I'd have gone out and I had, you know, I had an idea of the story in my mind. So you'd put together the interviews and the various, hopefully you've got actuality, which is like stuff happening on camera that is not prompted by you but moves the story on. So you then sort of assemble that, and you assemble your best bits and you send it to a commissioner and hopefully they pay for it, and then you go out. I mean, it's a high risk way to do it. I don't do it that way anymore, mainly because of the Mosul thing, because no one bought that film, so you end up losing money. But I'd been really successful with it in Syria, so I kind of thought I could do it again, you know. Nowadays the way you should normally do it is you go out there with a commission, so you know what you need, and you know you're filming and you're sending stuff back as you go, so it's kind of cut, and then when you get back you sit in a room, not on like this, you know, with an editor and a few screens, and pull something together and then work on it until you're happy with it.
Mosul was high risk, we can safely say that.
Mm-hmm.
Somalia, was that the same? That's 2018.
Yeah. Mosul, yeah. Somalia was high risk in that the threat was like pervasive. Like there's no clear front line. Someone could come up to you in the street and do it and shoot you or whatever, and did regularly. You know, there were loads of assassinations going on there. And Westerners would get lifted if they were outside of the international airport like area. So it's incredible. Like, it was a tough place to operate.
So you'd be going out into the streets in Mogadishu?
Yeah, but I would never go. I would like never be allowed out without like a literal truck full of armed blokes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like they would drive in front of me and I'd have my own personal like bodyguard, and away we went.
Who said lift you for what? For ransom?
Yeah. Or just shoot me offhand, yeah.
What was going on there, or what is going on
there?
So
that's Al-Shabaab fighting for control of Somalia, which is, you know, they're an Islamic fundamentalist group that is, yeah, on the Horn of Africa. And they've been fighting for 30 years to take over Somalia.
Well, when I think of Somalia and Mogadishu, am I right in saying that's Black Hawk Down, the film?
Yeah, I actually shot a lot of the photography I've done there was in the Bakara market, which is where that happened. And they're still like very anti-Western there.
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean, you're very fair-skinned, ginger hair.
Not ginger, what are you talking about?
Slightly. strawberry
African
blonde.
African sunset.
You don't blend in at all. Do you ever feel like you're a target?
All the time. Everyone stares at you like they want to kill you, like you've spilt their pint and it's 11:30. You know,
in a back pub in Birkenhead.
yeah, and you've just gone, oh, sorry, old boy, and wandered off. Yeah, and they stare at you like they want to murder you, for yes. Sure.
And does that take its toll?
Not really.
The way it is.
Just the way it is. Yeah. I know. It's not really. No. Yeah.
You,
I'm a cavalry officer. I'm used to people hating me. I'm used to people staring at me like they want to kill me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good point. So he's lived his life like that. This is an interesting one, and I didn't know. I did know you did this. You were going back to Syria, 2018, 2019. This is hours and hours and hours of content in its own self, and I'd recommend anyone go to this content that we're going to talk about in a second. You went out and you were filming. You know what I want to say? You explain it, who it was and what you were doing.
So I got asked to go and help find an American woman who had gone and joined ISIS. And was now left in the aftermath of ISIS somewhere in Syria, potentially.
She was a bride.
She was, yeah, an ISIS wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they was trying to find her, basically. An American woman called Samantha Al-Hassani. And no one really thought that we could find her because it was, you know, ISIS had just fallen. Like, the camps were groaning with people who no one knew whether they were ISIS or not. They didn't, you know, the massive upheaval. So no one was anticipating us finding her, but luckily we managed to.
What was her name?
Samantha El-Hassani. And that would go on to become, like, I was working with a guy called Josh Baker, seriously talented, like, tenacious journalist. And it was his story. He'd been chasing it. He had actually been blown up in Mosul. And so we had gone out and we had this wild goose chase around Syria, trying to find this woman. Like, we had a couple of times, like, these intelligence units would be like, turn up, have you hold a picture, have you seen this woman? They're like, oh, just left. So about 3 days before the end, and contacted my phoned me up out of, pretty much felt like out of the blue, and said, I hear you're looking for this woman. One of my contacts thinks that he can deliver her to you, but you can't talk to him direct. You can't know who he is. You just have to go to this camp to meet him. And I'm like, I trusted this contact of mine, but it's still Syria. So, you know, you're being told to go and meet someone at a military camp who you can't know the name of or discuss anything with. And so we're like, well, you know, it was based on my level of trust of my context. I was like, okay, let's do it. Slightly puckering, but went, and yeah, she was brought in with her two kids. And like, we'd found her when no one was finding anyone in Syria at that point.
What was the main reason to find her?
I think, well, at that point, there was no one really knew what it was like to be inside ISIS at that point. So it was like to get an insight as to what happened, and then to speak to as to why, you know, why did you do it? And to find out whether she was like a willing participant in it, or whether she was a hostage.
And her kids had been born under ISIS?
Good question. No, I think two of them hadn't been. I think there was one that had been. So she had three.
So you're in a refugee camp?
No, this was a military camp at this point. I've since been back to a couple of, they're not really refugee camps there, because like a lot of them, like Al Hol camp, for example, is, you know, at the time I went was 90,000 people. Yeah. And it was, you know, and 60% of that was people who were fleeing from ISIS, but the other 40% were either ISIS sympathizers or literal ISIS families who had been in Baghouz and were like hardcore ISIS to this day.
Oh, it's still...
There's like a mini caliphate there now. Like, people are getting their tents burned down, heads cut off. Like, they still believe there are Yazidi slaves inside that camp that people can't find because they just get hustled from tent to tent, and because everyone's fully covered up. Like, you can't see anyone.
So it's not the UN, it's not...
It's run by the Kurds.
But it's not an international organization running a refugee camp like you would
imagine.
No,
you've got some NGOs working inside there, but they don't administer the whole camp. No.
What's the impact of children? Because I'm picturing the absolute worst here.
Oh, it is the absolute worst. Yeah, yeah. Like, the mortality rate is through the roof, and like, you know, there was this this five-year-old girl that was literally beaten to death by her own grandmother for taking off her abaya, you know. Crazy, crazy stuff.
Conditions.
Tents, literal tents, and that's it.
And then, is there men in there as well?
Yeah, yeah. Family, full families, everything.
Do you see that aggressive, what's the word to say, is tensions high?
Definitely. I mean, you're like, we were always chaperoned inside in Hull, particularly. So we never really got to see it without guards around us. But like, the last thing that I got shouted at me before I left was, I hope you come back so you can cut your head off. Albeit I didn't understand this at the time. I thought she was saying goodbye.
I didn't.
Yeah, you should have done, though. Should have done.
And but you know these camps, sorry to dwell on this,
go on.
But I'm just trying to get it into my head, because that's 90,000 people. That's Twickenham Stadium to the rafters, England versus Wales. That's how many people are living in these camps, in tents. Half of them are fleeing the other half, and the other half are still devout to what they believe in. And there's all this kind of beheadings.
Videos, violence, coming out, tents getting set on fire, yeah.
But it isn't a refugee camp like you'd imagine. Is it mud? Shops? Is the...
Yeah, I mean, there's like shacks and stuff that have sprung up around it. Like, Hull is tacked onto a much smaller town that holds less people than the camp itself. There's a few like basic amenities and like NGOs that are supplying services and stuff there. But it's very basic.
When was the last time you were there?
I wasn't at Hull. Last time I was at Hull was 2019, and I've been back out in Syria. Was it about a month ago?
Yeah.
To a different camp.
What's the situation like now?
It's much calmer now. There's obviously still fighting around Deir ez-Zor for sure, and pockets of resistance and stuff. It felt a lot calmer and a lot. But then I was also in a slightly safer area than I have been previously.
You've got a young family now. Has your attitude changed towards all this?
The bar is definitely higher for that. You know, I wouldn't go out somewhere without a story in mind and without having sort of discussed it. Like, my wife, I was going out with my wife the first time I went out to Syria for the first time, my girlfriend at that point. And, you know, there wasn't any discussion. I just went and did it. Now there would definitely be some discussions if I was going to go out in a similar environment.
You know? But you're not driven by cash?
No. The story. I mean, cash is obviously an element to it because it's expensive business and, you know, we run a film production company, so you can't take too many gambles on that. But no, the story has to be a compelling one.
Another element of what you do when we talk about stories, you know, we're on a podcast platform now, you know, this film, and we've talked about the process and almost this kind of creativity in and through combat and conflict, really. You do a lot of work with military charities as well. Why do you feel, and there's so many different stories and angles you can come at this from, why do you think it's important that it is captured in film, so in a visual way?
I think it's the most engaging medium, like, to someone to be able to see themselves back. I think it can really change a person, you know, and for someone else, for someone's family to be able to see them talk about it. And I also think, you know, you'll have definitely noticed here, like, when you have a microphone in front of you, that, you know, it makes an occasion, it makes people reflect a bit more. Like, a camera just takes that to the next level in terms of testimony.
Mm.
So people find themselves saying and considering stuff they might not necessarily have thought of or gleaned before, you know?
Mm. Do you see it long term, this documentation of these military stories? Will it ever run out? Will there ever be a time when we're like, we're done?
When people stop going to war, I suppose. Mm. I don't think so.
Mal, thank you so much, mate, and we'll leave it there.